From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Imagine being sent to planet Mars on a one-way trip, never to come back to Earth, saying goodbye to family and humanity, knowing that you're going there and that you're going to die there. Well, there are people who are willing to make this sacrifice to get a seat on that first rocket to the red planet, who have actually signed up for the mission. And researchers are beginning to think through nitty-gritty fashion what a life lived on Mars would really have to be like. This hour, On Point, the emotional, the metaphysical, the practical facts of life on the red planet. You can join us on air or online. Is there anybody out there who would like to make that trip? Give us a call. We want to know how you'd get through living in a small pod with just a couple of other humans. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from West Orange, New Jersey, is Tarek Malik. He's managing editor of the online journal space.com. Tarek, welcome back to On Point.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And yesterday, for homework in preparation for today's show, I went to see the movie Interstellar, which to some degree inspired the conversation in our office that led to doing this show. And for those who haven't seen it, very basically, I'm not giving anything away. It's about a small group of individuals making a very, very long journey with the question always there of whether they will ever be able to get back home. And they kind of know that when they leave. And I think everybody comes out of that movie wondering just how far ahead in the future for us is that kind of space travel? Is it entirely stuff of fantasy, or is it beginning to come within the realm of practicality?
You know, I think that the concept of humanity as an interplanetary species is kind of closer than ever before when you think about the near targets, things like the Moon and Mars with permanent human settlements. What we've seen, you know, we may not be a true interstellar civilization yet, but when it comes to human spaceflight, we've seen some major strides just in the last decade or so. NASA just test launched its first deep space capsule in 40 years, the Orion capsule, last week. That's their first step to sending astronauts to Mars just in the next two decades. Then you mentioned that there's some volunteers that want to go on a one-way trip to Mars. There are people that are trying to develop the rockets that can make that happen in a month instead of 6 months. There are studies on Earth of people cooped up in a little base in Hawaii or in Russia that have been there for months, if not years at a time, to see, could we really handle that stress? So the parts are coming together, you know, where you would say maybe like in the next 5 years or so, we've got all the pieces we need to at least try to make the venture.
So technically, the parts are coming together. And what about the will, the political will, the financial will, assuming that this would have to be a government thing, and maybe that's the wrong assumption. About that side of it?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. The political will is really obviously driven by election cycles and whatnot. NASA's current push to Mars is driven by the Obama administration's goal of sending astronauts on deep space voyages by 2025, aiming for Mars and 2030. They still have to build a giant rocket for that. They need funding. We heard yesterday that that they don't have all the funding they need for that stuff. So that's going to be a huge challenge just to get the financial backing from a government for an effort like NASA. But on the other side is there are companies that want to do this on their own. Elon Musk, you know, billionaire head of Tesla and SpaceX, has said that he founded his company, SpaceX, really with the goal of sending humans to Mars. And he's building his own rockets to do that, his own vehicle, the Dragon spacecraft, to do that on the way. He's selling trips to, you know, space for NASA, to NASA, and building giant rockets. So those entrepreneurs, those efforts could be the way to get to Mars aside from these government efforts to kind of sidestep that political question.
So the bottom line, Tarek, is that getting to Mars in 10, 15 to 20 years is not anywhere close to being outside the realm of possibility. It's within the circle of possibility.
It's within the circle of possibility. There are technical challenges. That's a given. I don't think that they're insurmountable. And there are different ways to reach Mars as well. You've got people landing on the surface of Mars, people landing on a moon of Mars. There's one private effort that wants to just send a man and a woman on a slingshot trip around Mars. So they're really, the spectrum of possibilities is open now. with the technology that we have. And in the background, there's people developing new technologies that could make those trips even faster or even more of a reality in the next 20 years.
Aside from the sort of the poetry and the human adventure part of it, if you look at it as a science project, if you look at it as the purpose, if you look at the purpose of going to understand these planets better, why not send robots? What's better about sending people?
Robots are very capable. We've seen that with NASA's Curiosity rover on Mars, with the long-lived Opportunity rover. It's been there for more than a decade now, and so there's nothing to shake a stick at when it comes to sending robots out there. Humans, you know, they carry not just the wonder of exploration when you send them out to just to even anywhere on Earth, you know, let alone the Moon or Mars. But they can also do things faster. We've heard reports that a lot of the things that took the Opportunity rover, 2-3 years to do, an astronaut geologist might have been able to do in a few days or a week. So that pace of discovery could be a lot faster. Mm-hmm. We would cement our role as an interplanetary species when the first boots, touch the ground on Mars. And then there's a safeguard, too. You know, we're all on one planet in Earth, and God forbid an asteroid threaten our planet. If we've at least managed to make a foothold on another world, we've at least taken the first step to safeguarding the survival of that species, too.
Well, Tarek Malik is managing editor of Space.com. Thanks so much for joining us, Tarek.
Oh, thanks. It was a pleasure.
So to get to the poetry of the journey, I want to bring into the conversation now from New York, Kelly Girardi. Kelly Girardi has volunteered to travel to Mars on a one-way trip. That means really not coming back, as it says. The way she got into that, she's one of 660 finalists for the Mars One project. That's a project, I believe, out of the Netherlands, which says that it hopes to establish a human colony on Mars by 2025. We're talking about 11 years from now. Kelly has a day job. She's a business development specialist at Masten Space Systems. That's a rocket technology startup based in the Mojave Desert. Kelly, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, what is this about you and going to Mars?
Where to start? It's really exciting. I think Tarek hit on so many important points about the fact that we now live in a time where, in the first time in 4 billion years, it's possible for life to become interplanetary. So it's a really exciting time to start thinking about these challenges. And I, for one, of course, am someone that is willing to go there.
How did it come about that you're a volunteer for what may be a viable project?
Yeah, well, I've always certainly had a fascination with space. I work in the commercial spaceflight industry, so democratizing space and expanding our Earth's economic sphere are two things that are really important to me. And space settlement is an issue that I really feel passionately about. I think we need to go to space with the intent to stay. And I definitely want to put my actions where my thoughts are.
So Mars One is a project out of the Netherlands. And as I understand it, it's the financing for it comes from the notion of turning the journey to Mars and life on Mars into a reality television show and website that it will be funded by people tuning in to watch over a period of 10 to 15 years, maybe the rest of the lives of the astronauts, their lives in space. And they've gone out and rounded up. They put out we're looking for volunteers. They got something like 18,000 volunteers. And it came down to the 660 of which you are a finalist, and four would go in the first wave, and then another wave of four, and then another wave of four. And the plan is to be that you stay and live there for good. How did you qualify? In other words, how did you make the cut?
So the first group of people that applied, I read that there were over 200,000 applications.
Wow, 200,000.
When they first sent it out. So, which was so inspiring to me to see that 200,000 people from around the world were really looking at Mars as a potential option. It was just cool from a space industry perspective to see that amount of attention. I personally was just so thrilled that someone was talking seriously about space settlement that I applied. It involved an application that was written and a video portion explaining your motivations and explaining what you felt were your qualifications. And then the next step of that, the second round, where they started cutting it down, involved medical examinations And now we're at the point at which we are about to go into in-person interviews.
So I understand the day that you found out that you were accepted as a finalist, another big thing happened in your life.
Yeah, it was close by. It wasn't exactly day of, as was reported, but I did get engaged right around that time, which was, you know, an interesting celebratory time.
All right, so you get engaged to be married, and you sign up for a trip to leave Earth behind for good. How do those two things go together?
Well, there's a couple components there. You know, one, at a fundamental level, I don't think I would be compatible with someone who didn't really have the same vision as I, that space is something that humanity needs to extend our footprint in and that we need to settle. So at a very fundamental level, we agree and are completely compatible on that topic. And in terms of actually leaving the planet and, you know, me getting on a rocket and heading to Mars, there are a number of proof of concept missions that need to happen before then, not least of which is communication satellites and the deployment of rovers and a habitat, something to land to. So at the point at which, you know, we see these historic proof of concepts come to light, that's the point at which we have to really have that conversation and take that pillow talk a little more seriously.
Well, just for a little taste of what it will be like up there in August 2013, the Curiosity rover past the one Earth year mark on Mars and to mark the anniversary, rover sang this to itself. Kelly Girardi, that could be you. please stay with us. We're talking about what living on life on Mars would be like, leaving behind planet Earth and every living soul and plant and lake and ocean and blue sky. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As human travel to Mars begins to look truly possible and just maybe inevitable, we're trying to get our minds around what a life on Mars would be looked like and also the journey to Mars. You can join the conversation. Could it be just great all the way through, fabulous views and adventure and good food and friends? Or would it be desperately confining and lonely and crushing? What do you think would be the psychological and emotional challenges? My guest is Kelly Girardi. She has actually signed up to travel to Mars on a one-way trip on a project called Mars One. And as she has already told us, she's just driven by passion for the idea of the exploration, the travel, the science, the learning, the planting of a footprint far, far away from home. And Kelly, you've also told us that though you've been recently engaged, you've made it clear that you and your future spouse would agree to this separation if it came to be, and I guess a final farewell if you're the one who goes and he stays behind. Talk about that and also about everything else that you would leave behind. I mean, all friends and family and oxygen in the atmosphere and water in the rivers and greenery, all of that. How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, as far as my fiancé, to start, you know, as we spoke about before, we have a really compatible understanding of space and a passion for it. It's something that we share. So in thinking about this, you know, permanent separation, we really are holding off on that conversation in a really meaningful way until the point at which that rocket is ready to go, and I'm one of those people that are selected to make that journey. Mm-hmm. So for the time being, we're talking about the interesting aspects and the science and the learning and the necessity of settling space. At the point at which it becomes real for our family, we'll have those more difficult conversations. And in terms of, you know, the rest of life on Earth, all of the amazing things, of course, that you think about, the uniqueness of this planet, the water, the oxygen, the perfectly habitable environment for the human species, I think it's a framework question about how do you look at a journey to Mars? Do you look at it as a sacrifice or an opportunity?
And you?
And I have I look at it as an opportunity.
Is there
a new environment?
Is there sacrifice? Obviously there is, but is there painful sacrifice, do you think?
I think so. I definitely think that a mission like this wouldn't come without some sacrifice, but I think that fundamentally for me on a very personal level and even on a spiritual level, I would look at it more as an opportunity for the advancement of an entire species.
And just in terms of the the psychological pressures of being of let's say the journey before you even get there, the risk of an enormous claustrophobia, even though you're out in the middle of everywhere, the claustrophobia of the space that you can actually inhabit, and then on the planet again, presumably the space you could actually inhabit would be so small. Just as a psychological matter, taking aside the spiritual part of it, do you think you could handle that? Or do you not know?
I do think that I could. It's funny because my fiancé is actually claustrophobic and has a really tough time in small spaces and also in low-gravity environments. We've both done zero-G parabolic flights and the vomit comet. So he's definitely, and he'll be the first to say it, not a candidate for manned spaceflight. But I really do think that I could handle that. And I think that environment, of course, would be a challenge constantly. And survival is a full-time job in any hostile environment. But I do think that it's something that would be worthwhile and something that I had the fortitude to handle.
Well, we're asking our listeners, you know, to share their views on this as well. I mean, with whom does the Kelly's feelings resonate, and who would just like run from this screaming? Let's go to some calls now and bring in Dale from Knoll, Missouri. Dale, welcome to On Point.
Well, hi there, John.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. My physical and emotional thoughts on going to Mars is actually a really great one, personally. The emotional aspect of going to Mars would be, of course, leaving your family and friends behind. And I agree with the person you're interviewing.
That's Kelly Girardi.
Right now. Mm-hmm. With Jordan, yeah. I agree with her, and I'm in the same boat as her. I'm engaged, and my fiance is not wanting me to go. But my personal thought is it needs to be done.
Dale, I have to cut you off only because you're losing your line, but I think the message came across that you sound like you share a lot of Kelly Girardi's views, and in fact, situation, that the pull might just be irresistible for you, but it sounds as though you would have to work it out as well. Let's bring in Chris from Nashville. Chris, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
We're good, thanks.
I agree with going to Mars. I think that it's a great idea. I would go. I have a family though, so I would probably have to think about it pretty hard. If I was a younger man, I would have gone in a heartbeat. The reason I was calling though is that we actually have already done psychological experiments with this. I used to be in the United States Navy, and I was on submarines, which are pretty much exactly the same. You're in a hostile environment. You have no air except for what you make. You have no food except for what you bring with you. And we generate all our own electricity and do all that kind of stuff. And while you're under the water, you might be with people that you dislike. you don't get to choose who goes on the boat with you.
Right.
So
how'd you handle it?
I think that this was I did it for 8 years, and then I decided that I would want to spend more time with my family.
Wow.
But there were definitely times when everybody got stir crazy, and we were ready to get out of there. I think that that putting all the people that are thinking about going to Mars on something similar would definitely be helpful. It's a very unusual environment. It's kind of like 2 a.m. all the time.
Yeah. It sounds like you really have to get the right mix of people. And speaking on that in terms of mix of people, back in 1959, The Twilight Zone did an episode about a convict who was sent to another planet where he was entirely alone, and it really got to him.
I can't stand this loneliness one more day. Not one more day. By noon, when I can't keep my fingers still and the inside of my mouth feels like gunpowder and burnt copper. Down deep inside my gut, I get an ache that's just pulling everything out. Then I force myself to hold on for one more day. Just one more day. I can't do that for another 46 years, Alan. I'll go right out of my mind.
Credit to actor James Corey for that. Kelly, hang on. I want to introduce now somebody who's actually lived in space, orbiting Earth in near space, not months away on planet, but close by. But he was out there. Leroy Choi Chow joins us from Houston, and he's a former NASA astronaut. He's a veteran of four space flights, four times up there. He was commander of Expedition 10 on the International Space Station, two-man mission that lasted 6 months. From October of 2004 to April of 2005. He's now a space entrepreneur and chairman of the National Space Biomedical Research Institute user panel at Baylor College of Medicine. Leroy, great to have you on the program.
Hi, John. Nice to be with you.
Leroy, go right to it, sharing with us the psychological aspects of being out there for so long. All right, the guy we just heard about, he was out there by himself. Nobody's going to go out there by himself or herself, but the group's always going to be small. The space on the journey is always going to be cramped. Does it get to you?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, long duration space flight is not for everyone. It's a whole lot different thing if you're going up for a few weeks, or if you're going up for 6 months, or if you're going up for longer than that, or maybe forever. So you're going to have to look at different personality types to determine who would do well in that situation. In fact, who's motivated and who wants to do those different things. So you had shuttle astronauts that didn't necessarily want to go fly long duration space flight. And even in my situation, I'd flown three shuttle missions, and when the chief asked me if I wanted to join the Expedition Corps, I had to give it a couple of days thought to decide that I really did want to go live in space for what turned out to be 6.5 months in a pretty small area.
What tipped it for you?
Well, it was the sense of adventure and exploration. It was a big commitment, not just for the flight, but the training. The training actually was a little over 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. There was a big commitment on having to learn Russian, the Russian language, and having to spend half of my time during that 3.5 years in Star City outside of Moscow. So, you know, it was a lot to consider and a big commitment to make, but ultimately it was the adventure of doing this kind of a mission that pulled me in.
Let me ask you about it this way. And if you're going to jump off of a cliff into cold water, you're jumping for the adventure and for the splash and for the flight through the air until you hit the water. But you know the water is going to be really cold at the bottom, and so you brace yourself for that. And I think we can all relate to, you know, you do it and you brace yourself for it. How do you brace yourself for something that none of us has ever experienced before? Because we've all experienced cold, but experiencing the confinement, and more important than that, the distance that cannot be bridged quickly. You are out there, and Earth is impossibly far away. And I mean impossible, and if you needed a rescue in a day, it couldn't happen. And your loved ones are a radio transmission away that has a delay in it, that it's just so far away. How do you brace yourself for that?
Right. So at NASA, we study using analogs, and we prepared for space station missions by looking at the experiences in terrestrially in South Pole bases, in other areas, and in studies we've done in chambers. And so we were able to try to extrapolate what it was going to be like. And so if you take the space station experience and you try to extrapolate into what it would be like to go to Mars, it's a little more difficult because, you know, even on the space station, if you're flying for a very long time, in fact, the record is 437 days by a cosmonaut some years ago. The reality is that you know that you can come back down if there's an emergency. Mm-hmm. You can see the Earth. Now, if you're on a mission to Mars, as you say, whether the farther you get, the more time delay there is between transmissions just because of the great distances. And as you watch the Earth get smaller and smaller and then turn into a star, that's going to be quite a different experience psychologically. Now, I think what balances that is the excitement of going to Mars. You know, you're going somewhere. You're not just going out into space and watching the Earth disappear in among the star field and then returning. You're actually going somewhere, and to get there. And I think that the adventure of going there would temper that the psychological part. But again, it's not for everyone.
Did you have difficult moments with it, Leroy? Just the being out there, everything that we're talking about, did it ever get to you?
Well, it never got to me per se. I mean, we certainly had some tense moments, not so much fighting between the crew. Saljan, my crewmate, and I, we got along very well. And, you know, to fly a long-duration flight, you have to be of a certain temperament. You know, it's like I said before, it's not for everyone. You have to be relatively easygoing, willing to, mm-hmm. to give and take and you know, try to get along first and foremost. Most of the tension, interestingly, was, and you'll find this with most missions, was between the crew and the ground, because the ground, they don't really, they're not up there. They don't, they're not at the pointy end of the spear. They don't know what's going on. They can guess. They try to guess. And oftentimes they're trying to be helpful. And it's that way with any kind of a remote control, I guess. And so in that aspect, as you get farther away from Earth, you'll have less ground control. You'll be more autonomous. Mm. And in that perspective, at least, it would probably be a plus.
Be liberating. Leroy Kelly, I'd like to introduce one more voice into this conversation. Andrew Weir joins us from Stanford, California. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Martian. It's fiction. It's got a great first chapter because I read it last night. It really is gripping, but it's fiction, and it's the story of an astronaut who was left behind to survive on his own on Mars. It's being made into a movie that's due out late next year. And one of the reasons that it's caught on is that it's really fascinating exploration of the technical requirements of making it all work, a life on Mars. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us once again on Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So we've talked a little bit about the journey and the survival, and Leroy's been out there and spent the time in the void. You've written a book about a guy who gets stuck on the solid ground, but it's not home ground. What does it take to survive? What would life be like to make it survivable on the red planet?
Well, the first and biggest problem you have is that Mars has no useful atmosphere. So you need to live inside of a pressure container. It's effectively a vacuum. Another problem is it's very cold, so you'd need to keep yourself warm. Probably would want a reactor for power, especially if you're trying to colonize it and you need a bunch of energy to grow food and stuff, if it's not just a short-term mission. So you need energy. You're going to need some way to generate food, which takes a lot of space inside of a dome or something where you can grow crops, which you obviously can't do out on the freezing vacuum surface of Mars. And then one of the other biggest problems you'll have is the radiation. The sun emits a lot of ionizing radiation that the Earth's magnetosphere protects us from, but Mars doesn't have one, or doesn't have one that's strong enough. So you need to have, like, heavy radiation shielding, which you could maybe do by just piling dirt up on top of your habitat. But, there's a lot of challenges to permanently living on Mars.
So it sounds like a nasty place, but that it could be made comfortable? There could be a bubble of comfort inside that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just like we can accomplish it if it's important enough to us. The question is that the sort of thing that we want to put that kind of time and effort into? And of course, you ask a dork like me, I'm going to say yes, but not everyone agrees.
Are you a Kelly Girardi in terms of being one of those who wants to go? Would you want to make the journey and the trip?
No, absolutely not. I'm not that kind of brave. I like living on Earth. I like the comforts of. I'm not a frontiersman or a great explorer. I'm happy to sit at my computer and write about people who are.
And Kelly Girardi, I mean, everything that Andrew just has laid out for us about life there, you know all of this.
I read the book in one sitting. I was so riveted. I could not put it down. Thanks. Excited me. Even the challenges that he wrote about so masterfully, I was enthralled. And it just fueled my excitement for the planet.
So the harder and harder Mars sounds to be to live on, the more into it you get.
Well, the more important the goal becomes. Mm. To acknowledge all of the challenges serves to show us where we need to put our time and energy, and I agree with him completely. You know, you ask another space dork like myself, I think that it's absolutely important and crucial for us to start solving those technical challenges.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're imagining and trying to anticipate what life on Mars would really mean, not just the physical realities, although those also, but how the mind and the soul and the hearts of those first astronauts would endure leaving this planet and all that's familiar forever. You can join this conversation. What would it be like to adapt and What do you think it would take, a rewiring of the brain or a new philosophy or religion or medication or meditation? My guests are Kelly Girardi, who has actually volunteered for a one-way trip to Mars, Leroy Chow, a former NASA astronaut, and he's a veteran of four space flights. He spent 6 months as commander of the International Space Station, and Andy Weir, who's author of the best-selling novel The Martian. And I just have to point to one tweet that we've received. Jonah Fontella is referring to the call we had earlier where the line dropped. He says, a guy just called into On Point Radio to talk realistically about living on Mars, but his cell phone cut out. And he finds the irony irresistible. Some other tweets. 150 years ago, immigrants left families and never saw them again. It's not so different from Mars today. And they had no email, but they did have people when they got to the other side. Let's go to some more calls. We have India calling from Boston. India, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Kelly, I just wanted to applaud your bravery for volunteering for a mission like this. We certainly need our explorers and just as much as we need, you know, our farmers here on the ground. I cannot imagine taking on something like this, not only for the solitude, though I enjoy my own moments of quietude. I look forward to my Sundays with my church community and my family and friends. The biggest thing, I think, is, as you said, John, the air and the lakes and the greenery. I can't imagine not having my garden. I struggle with the idea of moving from my six-unit condo with a big garden that I get to work in every day to a bigger building where I'll have a terrace with just a few potted plants.
You're saying, India, you just couldn't let go of that. Well,
yeah, I'm very interested to see how the program will accommodate for that in the journey of, will they grow green things? Will they have smells like, will there be, you know, baking bread smells or things to make the astronaut connect with Earth. Let's ask
Leroy Chow about what, when you were in the International Space Station, what did they do, actually, to India's point, to give you the feeling of home? What were the accommodations?
Well, India makes a really great point because besides family and friends, the thing I missed most was nature. Even though from our perch on the ISS, we could look down at the rainforest, beautiful lakes, rivers, all kinds of natural beauty, we were very much in a sterile environment, except for one plant experiment we had on board. And it was really nice having that green plant up there that we could actually look at up close and touch. But I missed being down here and smelling grass and birds and flying around and squirrels running around. You really do miss all that. And so on something like going on a trip to Mars, I think we would have to find ways to adapt and not necessarily try to synthetically make that, because oftentimes people have shown that the more you try to make something like home, the more you make them miss it. So
I think adaptation
is the key.
So too many pieces of home would be making it more difficult to let go and keep going, it sounds like you're saying.
Right. That's one school of thought, and I think there's some truth to that.
But I'm assuming you brought along books and music and photographs and that sort of thing, those pieces of home.
Yes, we did, definitely did. And that was all nice. It was very nice to have photographs and electronic books sent up. And of course, we had a pretty good DVD library, although these days DVDs are
well, let me
on
ask,
the way out.
Let me ask Andy Weir. I mean, is it going to be possible to get Netflix when you're on Mars? Is there going to be a feed?
Who's
the provider?
Anywhere between 5 and 24 minute communication delay, I think, is what it works out to be. So, but data is data. You could absolutely get the latest movies from Earth for the rest of your life while you're living on Mars. And as for the caller's concern about gardening, well, believe me, she'd get plenty of that if she was part of a colonization effort. You'd have to do that or die.
Oh, interesting.
So, plenty of opportunities to grow plants.
Let's bring in Guadalupe from Clarksville, Tennessee. Welcome. You're on Point.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. Would you go?
Yeah. My thing is, to be up there and stuff, the solitude's great for me anyways. But I would want to start rethinking the way we look at things, because here on Earth, we have too many wars, too many political, geopolitical bull junk going down. If we were up on Mars, we would have to rethink everything and try to almost like make it like a utopia.
But the solitude, you said, would be great for you? I mean, you think you could adapt to that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a truck driver. I do that by living, so okay. Solitude's nothing to me.
Interesting. All right. Thanks very much for your call. And let's also bring in Marcia from Iowa City, Iowa. Welcome to On Point, Marcia. Would you go?
Greetings, Gersling. Hey, your previous caller. It's not solitude when you're in there with other people,
right.
Believe me. Since I was a little kid, I wanted to colonize other planets. I'm 60 years old. Maybe they could use a grandma. But we really do need to get off this planet. We need to send a follow-up group, too. I wouldn't expect all the missions to be successful. It's going to take a huge amount of resources, not just money, but the money that represents natural resources and people extracting them and all the transportation. And even if we took the cost of these missions and applied them to the problems on the Earth, it wouldn't be successful because of the geopolitical problems. And so I do think we need to get off. It'll be the elitist and very special and people that get to go, but they need to go. We have no reason to think that we can eliminate the problems on Earth. But I do think we need to leave the sentiment behind, the idea of not being able to, not being able to smell fresh bread. It's like, okay, get realistic here. And it's a survival experience, not a comforting experience.
Marcia, you're a believer in exploring brave new worlds, obviously. And what's interesting is, the reference back to Star Trek there, that we've been talking and dreaming through art and literature about this journey forever. And I think people might forget that John Carpenter's first movie back in 1974 was called Dark Star. And it was a dark comedy, in fact, about a crew of, back in those days, they would be kind of considered hippies and slackers who got together and were journeying around the universe for 20 years, roaming the galaxy. And they spent a lot of time reminiscing about the Earth.
20 years in space, 1 million light years from Earth. Their job is to clear a path for the colonization of space.
Back home in Malibu. I used to surf a lot, Talby. I used to be a great surfer.
Dark Star. They're not lost in space. They're loose.
Kelly Girardi, loose in space. It sounds a little bit more like your vision of it, that being out there in a tin can without a lot of other people around, you actually find as a form of liberation and expansion.
Yeah, definitely. I think Marcia actually brought up an interesting point. She called it sort of an elitist group and only more special people would be selected. But I really feel as though it's quite the opposite. This is truly a colonization effort would, as proposed currently by commercial industry, would really entail such a diversification of people. It would be more the democratization of space as opposed to the select elitists. That's not to say that an inordinate amount of training would not go into it. Of course, you need to prove the capability and follow through on that training. But in the selection process, that's one of the things I applaud most about Mars One, is that it really was open to everyone and allowed every single person to see an opportunity for themselves in space.
Let's bring in Dave from Hamburg, New York. Dave, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John.
Hey.
My question is, because this journey is going to be a reality TV show, we all know that drama sells. Do you think the creators are going to somehow try to create drama by maybe getting people who don't get along or diverse people just to create dramatic situations? They'll take it off the air. Thanks.
Like having somebody voted off of the spaceship.
Yeah, that sounds awful.
That's a great question, I think. If this thing is funded as a reality show, does that compromise the science and the motivation and everything else? I think, Andy, where were you trying to speak up on that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think the connotations of getting voted off the spaceship are very good.
No.
Also... Yeah, I don't imagine – Kelly would be able to tell you much more about this, but I don't imagine that they would compromise their mission to for drama purposes. Although I do, to be honest, I don't see how they can possibly get enough money to fund it with just reality TV show revenues. I mean, I've got to assume they'd have other revenue streams.
Do you basically, Andy Weir, I mean, at the beginning of the show, Tariq Malik talked to us about a number of government projects and commercial projects that are in the works that he thinks are, I guess the way to put it would be potentially plausible. They're not there yet, but he would definitely not rule them out. Is Mars one of those, or do you think it's less likely to actually happen?
I'm sure it could happen if they got the funding, but I just don't I don't see them get. I mean, to actually send people to Mars, you're talking about the $100 billion range, you know, by even the most conservative estimate. And I mean, that's reality shows don't make that much money. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that they're working on other avenues of revenue.
And Larry Cho, in terms of figuring out who can make it, as you said, it's got to be the right kind of person. Is there literally a battery of tests that you can go through to figure out who should be there and who should not?
Part of astronaut selection is you do go through a whole battery of psychological testing. You have a one-on-one interview with a psychiatrist, and so there is a fair amount of screening. But you know, for figuring out who would be good on a long duration flight and who might not, that's more experience. That's more getting to know people. That's part of the reason the training flow is so long, is so that the group that's training for a space station can get to know each other better, can spend a lot of time together. The doctors and the senior management can observe them. And very important, what you need to do is select your commanders and then base your crew selections on your commanders. You talk to your commanders. What do you think of these people? Which ones would you definitely fly with? Which ones would you definitely not fly with? You know, things like that. And the Russians learned long ago. They've been flying long-duration flights much earlier than we have. And they learned long ago the importance of crew composition on a long-duration flight. On a short mission, you know, everyone can get along for 2 weeks. But when you're talking about 6 months off the planet or even longer, you know, the Russians got in trouble early on in their program where on at least two missions they had to end early because the crews were literally ready to kill each other.
And Leroy Chow, I've called you Larry Cho, and you were polite enough just to jump in as though I'd used your correct name, so I apologize to you. Let's go to Joanna calling from Stowe, Massachusetts. Joanna, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. I was calling just with the idea that the traveling somewhere where you're leaving everything behind is not totally unprecedented, in that people who settled America did that. They left Europe and everyone and everything they knew to come here for something uncertain.
And political refugees do the same thing all the time. But do you think, Kelly Girardi, there's a big difference between that and the choice that you're making to go off into space?
I mean, I certainly agree that there are analogies throughout history for making a choice that many would see as an extreme sacrifice. I certainly think that this would be on the more extreme end, of course, leaving everything behind, as you said, with no quick rescue ship to get you back home in the case of an emergency. But, you know, I do agree that it is precedented for people to make these sort of exploratory decisions in pursuit of exploration and science and progression.
And Brooke calling in from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Welcome, Brooke.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Well, your guest sort of just spoke to it a little bit about, you know, picking the crew, training them, making sure that they're prepared for something like this. But, you know, I'm sitting here wondering, this is essentially, I mean, they know this is a one-way street, so does your guest or do you guys really think that there are people who mentally, even if it's at some point on the trip, maybe once they get there, things like that, that can really handle the idea of this being it? I mean, humans have this innate desire to survive, and yet they know that they're sending themselves to something that's going to eventually end.
Yeah, that's
so
an interesting question.
I'm curious if you can speak a little bit more to that.
Maybe I'll take that to Andy Weir. You know, the question of do you have to? Does it mean you're crazy if you want to go? Number one, and number two, I'm assuming the answer is going to be no. But what if somebody does lose it halfway out there? Is there a backup plan for that?
Well, that's a real problem, right? If you're talking about a colonization effort, well, so people often kind of think of these two things as the same thing, like colonizing Mars versus a mission to Mars, but they're very different, right? Going to Mars on a manned mission where you're going to return has one psychology. Going to colonize it has an entirely different one. The Europeans who came over and colonized North America, there were already Native Americans here that they could trade and interact with, and a natural environment that they could live off of. Mars is very different. It would be a real struggle to survive. As for people losing control or becoming a problem, well, when you're in a colony, you have to have your own justice system. You can't just assume that everybody's going to follow the rules, and things could break down. It's a real risk.
Well, the whole thing gets more complicated, more fascinating the more we talk about it. And I want to thank everybody for taking part in this conversation. Commander Leroy Chow, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And Andy Weir, author of the best-selling novel, The Martian. Great to have you with us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And aspiring Mars colonist Kelly Girardi, who picked up some fans during this broadcast. We hope you make it to the Red Planet.
Thanks so much, John.
And you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, On Point, we have the Explosive Torture Report, the Rolling Stone and UVA, Ebola Heroes. It's our weekly news roundtable going behind the headlines. I'm John Donvan, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We'll be right back.